Just as a postscript to your question, I would encourage anyone to investigate if they find themselves engaging in over-efforting or striving, whether they're actually engaging with bhavana or if they're engaging with bhava, the desire to become, the desire to become a certain kind of person and have a certain kind of experience. You know? And I think this is one of those areas, probably the near enemy of bhavana probably is bhava. Mm-hmm. And it's quite good to investigate that in ourselves, because bhavana, although it requires effort, there's a lot of joy in it. You know, it's a genuine cultivation of what is ennobling. As hard as that may be, you know, as many challenges as we may feel, we've actually got our feet in the stream. Hmm? Whereas bhava is so often relying upon replacing one experience with a different experience, that it has a lot of self in it. You know, I need to make this happen, this exaggerated sense of responsibility. That is often very little joy in it. There's often a lot of tension in it. Yeah. So before I continue, is there anything else up? Any reflections? Yes, please.
So I think this issue of when is it avoiding and when is it skillfully sort of removing myself from situation, difficulty. What you were saying just a little bit ago is an ongoing question.
Yes.
And investigation. And it seems like one way is to slow down enough to investigate where is the aversion in this, where is the reactivity in this, is this actually reactivity or responsiveness? That's sort of as much as I can figure out right now. I would like you to say more about how to, ideas about how to engage with that.
Does everyone hear the question? What is the difference between avoiding and skillfully removing oneself from a situation that is unsupportive, unhelpful, irreconcilable, whatever it may be? And I think this is an ongoing question in many people's lives, actually. And, you know, the feeling even that if there's aversion there, you know, is that some message that I shouldn't step out of it? Not always, actually. You know, aversion, it doesn't always then send the message that, oh, there's aversion, therefore I should stay with the unacceptable. Okay? So I think that's very important to be clear about, you know. If you waited for a moment where there was no aversion present at all, you know, a person in an abusive relationship could die, you know. So just to be very clear on that. But it is really an investigation, you know, and I often, you know, really do look at the four wise efforts. You know, and how do they apply to that experience, you know, to bring into being the wholesome that's not already present. To deepen and sustain the skillful and wholesome that is present. To relinquish the unskillful, the unwholesome that is present. And I don't think we're just talking inwardly here, we're also talking outwardly. And so to abandon the wholesome and skillful, unskillful that is present, and to cultivate the conditions for the unskillful's non-arising. I'll give you a really, you know, a very obvious example like that. If I was an alcoholic, you know, I would cultivate the conditions of not hanging out in the bar rather than having a sort of you know, an outlook that says I'm going to hang out in the bar and show how strong I am in withstanding my temptation to drink, okay? So I often think of how those efforts apply to those choices. And when we talk about the skillful and the unskillful being present, these may be present inwardly and they may be present outwardly. So there are many instances, I think, where we recognize the conditions I am in have only one outcome, which is actually to perpetuate suffering. And that perhaps it's better just to get out. Now, these can be all kinds. This can be very subtle, you know. And it may not just be outwardly generated. It can be inwardly generated. You know, I think of a person I worked with as an example, someone who'd had a very abusive childhood, got a job as a court reporter in a courtroom that basically dealt with sexual assault cases. And she turned up every day. You know? It wasn't an unskillful environment. It wasn't an unskillful occupation, but it was unskillful for her to be in that occupation. And of course, you know, had the mentality of just toughing it out and I'm going to learn something from this. But actually, maybe that's not actually so. Maybe what we learn is how vulnerable the heart can be in being exposed to certain triggers which are actually unhelpful. So it's always an investigation, you know, and there is no prescription, there's no right answer. Sometimes we don't know we're making the right choice, and then we get out and we find that we've just taken it right with us and we're still doing the same old loops, you know, and maybe there's something there that we need to make peace with, either inwardly or outwardly, in terms of indebtedness. So I just feel that it's how can it be other than investigation? Otherwise, we just try and apply rules or prescriptions to it, which simply won't work. Yes, please. And the factors of awakening. Factors of awakening.
So those were the specific constructs that you feel.
I think it's good to appreciate that this is an ongoing exploration in terms of the Buddhist academia. You know, if you read the third way of establishing mindfulness, it's kind of clear. It's not really, it doesn't actually point to thoughts. It speaks about the mind that is affected by lust, the mind that is affected by metta, the mind that is affected by hatred, the mind that is affected by generosity. So it's really, really pointing towards the actual climate of the mind. It doesn't actually say, look at thoughts. It's actually pointing towards really examining the shape of the mind. But of course, the shape of the mind, the actual climate of the mind, the mood or the mental state, is invariably productive. Okay? So what we do see is that there are certain states of mind, particularly the more unhelpful and unskillful states of mind, that actually are very productive in terms of generating mental activity aligned with those states. You know, if I have a mind affected by anger, it's very, very likely I will have a big story of anger. Okay, the narrative will be quite big. It's also very noticeable that in the more skillful, we call them wholesome states of mind, generosity, calm, kindness, the narrative gets very small. With the big narratives, the sense of self within them is also, the volume is cranked right up. Within the wholesome states of mind, the sense of self, the volume of that seems to get turned right down. So instead, it does seem in the Satipatthana that the Buddha's particularly concerned with actually looking at the underlying condition that actually creates our world of the moment. Now, many of those narratives, of course, which is why, you know, there's not much mention of thought in the Satipatthana. There's plenty of mention of thought in other discourses. You know, that wonderful word, papancha. So there's plenty of mention of thought in other discourses, but not particularly in the Satipatthana. So the contents of mind, you know, there are some textual scholars who will put the contents of mind into the fourth foundation of mindfulness, even though there's no mention of thought there. And there were some who would include it in the third foundation of mindfulness, even though there's no mention of thought there. Okay, so, you know, it's that ongoing investigation of what do we do with this aspect of our experience that is actually occupies such a lot of space, you know. So it's also important that, you know, rather than trying to fit it neatly in, it's to recognize that certainly thought does occupy a great deal of space in our experience. In fact, it's one of the more troubling aspects of our experience. So the Buddha doesn't abandon that. It's just not specifically focused on in the Satipatthana. So then if you go to the Honeyball Sutta, this deals particularly with thought. Okay? So I guess the Buddha didn't say everything in one place at the same time, you know, because there was too much to say. I mean, that's kind of my sense of it, you know. Like, there was too much to say, so he didn't say everything in the same place at the same time. He didn't try and cover every single base in every single discourse, in every single teaching, you know, as we know it. So you go to the Honeyball Sutta, and actually you look at what the Buddha has to say about thought and the key role that thought plays in actually shaping our experience. So you've got that formula again that I think I've mentioned here sometime, that what we contact, we feel, what we feel, we perceive, what we perceive, we proliferate about, what we proliferate about, we dwell upon, what we dwell upon becomes the shape of our mind. Now this is interesting because it's a reversal. So in the Satipatthana, although there's not much mention of thought, you know, I think it's an assumed recognition that the mind affected by lust, the mind affected by anger, is going to be proliferating. In the Honeyball Sutta, what you see is that introduction of thought quite early on in the mental process, and that actually creating the state of mind. So it's almost going backwards. So it's very important to see that it's not a one-way street, because, you know, you can walk outside, you know, and, you know, you see something or you hear something, you know, and you see how immediately that contact, you have a feeling about it, you start to think about it, you know, and you have a state of mind. Again, you could walk outside with a state of mind, you know, already in place, contractedness or aversion, and you are going to have thoughts about what is perceived. So this is a very much a two-way street, okay? Thoughts create mental states create thoughts. Okay? So in the Honeyball Sutta, actually, if you're ever interested, if you look in the middle length sayings, the grouping of discourses, I think it's 16 to 20, deals specifically with world construction through thoughts, through mental states, through proliferation. And we have then that wonderful word, papancha, which everybody is familiar with. It's one of my favorite Pali words, you know. Rolls off the tongue, you know. Everybody familiar with what papancha means? A proliferation of thinking based on underlying views, moods, mental states that distorts our capacity to see the way things actually are. Papancha. Papancha has basic themes. So there is aversion-based papancha. Plenty of that we know about. There is greed-based papancha. There is fear-based papancha. There is view-based papancha, you know, all my opinions. And there is self-view-based papancha, the story about me. So those are our five basic themes of papancha and proliferation. So if we were going to bring that into the light of investigation, we don't just stay with the Satipatthana alone. We actually start to look at how our world is being constructed moment to moment, and the way that these different threads of papancha rooted in mental states and views are actually constructing our world of the moment. Does that answer your question? That was a very long answer. Yeah, good. Has anybody else got anything out? Yes, please. Something here that's not quite landing. It's not necessarily cognitive, no. It's not necessarily, I mean, there is cognition within it because the hindrances produce stories. You know, all of the hindrances of, okay, craving for sensual pleasure, aversion, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, doubt, they all produce a lot of cognition. Okay? But it's actually, as I say, that the fourth foundation, there's nowhere in the Satipatthana that actually focuses upon thought very specifically. If you want to focus on thought very specifically, you go to the Honeyball Sutta and plenty of others. Okay? But don't try and fit it into the Satipatthana. It's not there. Let's look at thought. It's not there. Establishing mindfulness in the body, establish mindfulness in the hedonic tone, establishing mindfulness in the affective tone, and establishing mindfulness primarily within these aspects of psychological experience, which are the hindrances and the awakening factors. Yes.
I just first of all wanted to offer an appreciation for your examination of words and winnowing words perhaps out of one's casual vocabulary. Also look sort of investigating what the words have behind them, whether or not they came from another tradition.
Yeah.
Just going back to the idea of sympathetic joy or empathetic joy.
Or appreciative joy.
Appreciative joy. In another context, this was brought up by the group, maybe empathetic joy would be a better term than sympathetic. And someone pointed out that perhaps empathy has a starting point in the I, as in I know how you feel, rather than a type of response to something in terms of sympathy. Let's say vibrating like a string is sympathy with another string.
To tremble with. You see, I think there is a big part of empathy and appreciative joy. You know, it's almost with compassion, the heart trembles in the face of suffering. And I often think of appreciative joy as the heart that can tremble with the happiness and the well-being of another. So I don't personally feel that empathy has that sense of I in it. I think it actually relies upon the muting of selfing, you know, that sense that I know how you feel. I don't know how you feel, but I can stand in the face of your happiness and actually feel the waves of that happiness kind of run through my whole being, and I'm delighted. You know, there's a sense of delight in it. So I do think there's a very strong quality of empathy, actually, in appreciative joy. Because, and I think this empathy is so powerful in the Brahma Viharas, not only in the face of suffering, but in the face of the lovely. And you know, that is often a big part, only not only of appreciative joy with another person, but actually with appreciative joy with life itself. You know, to stand in the sun and feel the sufficiency of that moment, and to have your heart tremble just with the simple delight of it. You know, just with the simple delight of it. You know, so again, with this domain of the Brahma-Viharas, you know, because we have inherited them primarily as being focused around human domains, personally I feel it's so important to expand that, you know, beyond the human domains, between the delightful events, the delightful experiences, the delightful sense impressions, to have one's heart tremble just in the simple sufficiency of that moment. You know, for me that's a very big part of appreciative joy, that it's not only about the person in front of me, it's about those many moments in my day when I pause and actually know that simple sense of enough. There is enough in this moment. And actually to feel the heart tremble with that, the delight of that. That would be my sense of that. I mean, I think the human domain is a doorway, you know, that opens up sometimes our awareness of the obstacles to that trembling. You know, and I think of there's some phrases from a Sri Lankan text, you know, that particularly focus upon the human domains of appreciative joy. And, you know, they go something like this: how wonderful you are in your being. I delight that you are here. I rejoice in your good fortune, and may your happiness continue. Now, I think about, you know, if we use the human domains also, many people would find it easier to actually use those phrases in relationship to another person. But what is it like to turn those inwardly? How wonderful I am here. I delight in my being. You know, it's like most people go, no, you know, no, I don't deserve that, you know, I'm not worthy of that. And yet that's part of that appreciative joy. But then to expand, I think, really, into those, and I feel this with all the Brahma-Viharas, to limit them to human domains is to limit their capacity in terms of awakening factors. Sorry, I interrupted you. Okay, let's talk about the embodiment of insight. Now, this is, I think, really concerned with this movement from conceptual knowing to lived experience. Okay? And I think it's the most challenging area of our lives in many ways, the embodiment of understanding. And yet it's also the most pivotal. Because I think looking at this movement from conceptual knowing to lived experience really kind of heightens or highlights our awareness of dissonance. Remember, this is how we started talking yesterday. And the deep discomfort of dissonance, those gaps that we can be so aware of, acutely aware of in our life, between what we know and how we live, between what we know and honor and how we relate, you know, between what we aspire to and then what we give energy to. I mean, this is what this whole question of embodiment is really concerned with, is the sense of those gaps, the sense of the discomfort of that dissonance, and really realizing that dissonance may be an optional domain of suffering. The dissonance certainly leaves a long trail of suffering behind it, and in itself, I think, is an experience of suffering. You know, so dissonance leaves behind it this trail of regret, of self-judgment, of self-blame, of shame. It leads to the world of shoulds, doesn't it? The shoulding mind: I should have done this, I shouldn't have done that, I should have been like this, I shouldn't have been like that. You know, those endless unfinished symphonies that we can go to bed with at night. And actually the shoulds, in my experience, lead to an even greater disembodiment. Because it's often, you know, such an expression of aversion in itself that it just leads to the deepening of the pattern of aversion. Now, my sense with the Dharma, and I mentioned this earlier today, that I think the great genius of the Buddha was to build upon what we have already glimpsed or already know. So the Buddha was not particularly interested in importing exotic or alien concepts. You know, the Buddha was a pragmatist. You know, he was a pragmatist. He was directly concerned with the experience of suffering, the causes of suffering, and the end of suffering. You know, he wasn't particularly interested in metaphysics, you know, other worlds. You know, he was actually concerned with our lived experience and the very pragmatic approach to looking at that experience, to seeing where there is distress, to understanding how it's caused, and to bringing it to an end. So, you know, it is interesting when people listen to the Dharma, and I, you know, I'm very reluctant to use the word Buddhism, which actually was a word invented in the 18th century by British explorers in India, decided there were Buddhists in the world. But he was not interested in importing sort of belief systems. He was obviously interested in inviting people to investigate in their own experience, is this true for you? And you know, my own sense in the Dharma, the way that it kind of lands easily with many people, of course, is simply because this can happen. We can investigate it in our own experience. We can question it. It often rings very true for us, simply because we have that access. So I want to go through the list of what we know. This may not be what we live, it may not be what we embody, but it's what we know. And I'm very happy if you want to add to this list, okay? And when I go through this list of what we know, I would invite you to, let's take just a moment after each piece that I kind of guess of what we know, and just to have a moment of reflection. You know, what are we strong at? What are we less strong at? What do we embody? Where is there a really big gap? You know, maybe there's a little crack, maybe there's a chasm. You know, and to be able to undertake that reflection without any sense of judgment, without any sense of blame, but just as a sort of honest exploration. So we know about impermanence. We know about change. In fact, our whole life has been teaching us about the unarguable nature of change. Sometimes welcome, sometimes unwelcome, but it is. And we know this. We know that it runs through all experience. We know that it's an unarguable. You know, we know that it touches the lives of everyone we love and care for. We know that it touches the life of our body and our minds on a moment-to-moment level. We know about impermanence. This is the one place. Does anybody in this room disagree? We all know this. Okay, just to have that sense. What are the implications of that? How do I live that knowing? We know about uncertainty and instability, all of the ways in which our world can crumble in a moment. We know that we cannot find certainty and stability in a world of unstable and changing conditions. I think we know this. We know about dukkha, particularly the pain of pain. We know about illness, about the ways, the vulnerability of the body. We know about the pain of pain. We know about aging. We know about mortality. We actually know the first ennobling truth. That there are no exemptions. Now we get maybe a little bit more argument territory. I think it takes us only a little bit of investigation, of looking at our own emotional, psychological process, to know that self is not a noun but a verb, an endlessly changing process shaped by conditions and shaped by clinging. We know that to live in a world governed by craving, fear, and aversion only has one outcome: the furtherance of emotional or psychological pain, defensiveness, and ill will. I think we know this. We know the power of generosity. We know that without the generosity of so many in our life, we would not be here. We know that the small acts of generosity we engage in ennobles our own hearts. We know the value of mindfulness, of being present in our lives in a way that enables responsiveness, enables appreciation, and delivers a refuge from being lost in past and future preoccupations. We know the power of kindness and compassion. We know the power of receiving kindness and compassion from others. We also know the way in which our capacity to live, to speak, and act with kindness and compassion benefits the well-being of others and ennobles our own hearts. We know that grasping and clinging leads primarily to agitation, and we have all known moments of the relief of non-clinging and non-grasping. We know the value of inner stillness, the ground of inner listening and responsiveness. I think we know that genuine joy and happiness can only be generated inwardly. That reliable joy and happiness can only be inwardly generated. Okay, that's my list of what we know. Does anyone have anything to add to this list? We know that we are all interconnected. Does anybody argue with anything on this list? Does anybody feel that voice inwardly that says, oh, I don't know that. That's news to me. This is the ground of the Dharma, isn't it? This is the kind of ground of the teaching, is to remind us of what we know. Okay, so what is our response to what we know in terms of embodiment or dissonance? I I mean, I do feel this, you know, this sense of knowing. It's very clear within us, but it's often obscured. And, you know, I think it is that place in walking this path, you know, that, you know, sometimes referred to as conscious incompetence, you know, that we know what's going on and we're doing it anyway. And, I mean, I'm going to invite us to have a 5-minute stretch, but I'd like to invite you to take 2 questions into that stretch. And one question is, because we're aware of this dissonance often, aren't we, between what we know and how we live. So the first question I'd really like you to take into that 5-minute stretch is, what is it that makes us forgetful? What is it makes us forgetful that creates dissonance? Because it seems to me that dissonance is a lot about forgetfulness. It's about forgetting what we actually know. So what is it that makes us forgetful, that sort of gets in the way of living that knowing? And the second question I would ask you to take into our stretch is, what is needed for us to naturalize our knowing, to let it sink into our bones and be the foundation of all of our thoughts, words, and acts? Are you clear on those questions? Say if you're not. Sure. So what is it that makes us forgetful? Appreciating how much forgetfulness is part of dissonance. So it's really what gets in the way of embodiment. And the second question is, what is needed for us to naturalize our knowing? For our knowing really to sink into our bones and be the foundation of all our thoughts, words, and acts.